Hey, listener. Welcome to Ants, Humans, and Stars. I'm Caleb, an artist with a story to tell. And here is the one and only world traveler, Digo.
A digital nomad for your listening pleasure.
That's right. That's right. So today I'm just telling you guys about a man who, if we were putting together an Olympic team of musicians, should definitely have a spot on the roster. He's a legend, a child prodigy, and quite frankly, a genius. And no, I don't say that lightly. I'm talking about none other than Stevie Wonder. And while I could easily spend multiple episodes covering his vast array of hits, today we're going to discuss his biggest, which, you know, you might be surprised to hear, is I Just Called to Say I Love You. Yeah.
That's the song I think about. 100%.
You think of Stevie?
Yeah. I just called
to say I love you.
And it has No Halloween, right?
No Halloween.
Which,
yeah.
You were like, mm-hmm. You were like, there's no Halloween. Wait, there's no Halloween and No Halloween. And I'm like, there's definitely Halloween in there. Because anyway.
You're right. That's right. All right. So tell us all about what you're going to be telling us about today.
And I will be covering how the Olympics don't care about you and scandals. Mm. Crazy events and decades and decades of negligence.
I was about to be like, listeners, write in and let us know.
Charles Deagle's gonna be stuck here for like a day trying to come. I was like, what's the word?
Exactly.
Night comes, sun rises. What's the word?
Olympic scandals. Where's Olivia Pope when you need her?
I'm gonna be get into it, and today I guess I'll go first.
You know, I think we should start off though by talking about the Olympics, which I really just want to say that I was so for those of you guys listening who don't know, during the week I play at Cancer Center here in this Virginia area, and at one of the locations I was playing at, they had the Olympics playing, and their rock climbing is a part of the Olympics. Did you know that,
Caleb? I didn't know walking fast was part of the Olympics. I swear to God, that is today I saw a clip of people walking fast. I was astounded, and this has been going on for
a while.
Like it's not like
it's not new.
That last year, no, I completely. That was part of a sport. Is rock climbing new?
I don't think it's new. Which my only only reason for bringing that up was that because skateboarding this year is the first year that it is a part. It's an Olympic thing.
Because I saw a photo of somebody with Tony Hawk, and I was like, what does that have to do with? Are they skating? I was like, but they're not skating at the Olympics.
That's what they are.
So they are the first skating year at the Olympics.
Yeah, and you know, there was a little, I don't even know want to say controversial, but I just remember reading like a headline of people like, you know, should skateboarding be the Olympics? And I'm Jesus. Like, what if rock climbing
and walking fast
is at the Olympics? Then yeah, skateboarding should be at the Olympics. And yeah, I was just like, wow, I didn't know. There was actually a guy named Caleb who was, I think his name was, he was rock climbing. His name was like Caleb. No, his name was Colin Duffy. Never mind. But there was somebody named Caleb who was competing. But anyways, it's just, yeah, there's so many, what do you call those? Not categories. That's not the word that they use. But yes,
types
there's so
of
many
sports.
Yeah.
They're all sport in some way. I mean, you need physical prowess to skate. Mm-hmm. And also, I'm thinking now, like, they should do skateboarding and tricks. And then they should also just like bobsledding, like
isn't that that's what the Winter Olympics that's already isn't that
no I know
already?
But like bobsledding, you pick a mountain and you longboard, so there's skating, the tricks and everything and whatever, and then a skateboarder, a longboarder going down 60 miles an hour and dangerous and everything, but hey, this is an Olympic event. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm open to anything being in the Olympics because, as I will illustrate, they don't care about you.
Or your mama.
They don't care about you. I haven't watched a second of the Olympics. All I've watched is the controversy, the whatever, everything mm-hmm. that's been coming up.
I haven't turned on the Olympics, but I've seen.
I've quickly switched the channel when I saw the Olympics come up.
I can't. I've
quickly switched the channel.
I can't.
I don't know, like. And
I think they're cool. It's just never been a thing for me because I was never into sports. So it was never like something that I was like, oh, I gotta watch it.
I don't like to watch. I like to play. I don't like to watch.
And yeah.
And it's funny how the reverse is what like most people who are obsessed with sports don't do sports.
Mm-hmm.
In my life, I've only encountered, it's not like, oh, you know, I really love American football and I play football every weekend and I've played football in college or whatever, or I'm really into, you know, gymnastics and I've done gymnastics all my life and I watch gymnastics. No, it's just,
yeah,
I am from Virginia and I follow this team because of where I live, or that's usually what it is. Or and mm-hmm. if you're, you know, part of a major city like New York or San Francisco, there's lots to choose from. You know, there's baseball, football, everything, you know, like, well, of the top American sports. And then other major cities like Buenos Aires and Brazil and then Spain, you know, it's all about football and football and football, international football, soccer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, but if you're not out of those cities, you're basically not a part of it. You're not really that obsessed. Anywho, all that to say is that, yeah, I mean, like, I like to play.
Yeah, rather than watch. No, I'm the same way. Like, I really enjoy tennis. I enjoy baseball. But these are things that I want to play. I don't want to watch mm-hmm. tennis, even though shout out to Serena. But I don't want to watch, and I don't want to. It's same thing with baseball. Oh, I'd rather watch football. I'd much rather watch football. I'd rather play these things than.
I mean, do you want to sit and watch people play video games all day?
I mean, people, you know what? So funny you bring that up because I was going to. That's definitely a thing now. So there was this game on. I technically still have the app on my phone, but I don't play. But it's called Marvel Contest of Champions. Mm. And it's literally just every Marvel possible character. And you get them and you fight and yada, yada, yada. Anyways, you look it up. Mm. But there was a guy who I started. There was actually a couple of guys who I would watch them play on YouTube because you would see. One, they would like show you like, hey, this new character just came out and, you know, you'd have to learn each new character. So it was helpful to watch someone else play.
Mm.
And then they're telling you, like, here's the moves, A, A, B, up, or something. So it was also helpful. And then, I can't lie, it was just like, I would put them on the background, I would play their videos on in the background while I was playing the game. Just so you're, like, playing the game, but you also, I'm getting information. So all that to say that, maybe if I was into sports, then maybe I could understand wanting or getting some form of enjoyment out of watching it.
But to keep this analogy, so would you watch those videos on YouTube with this game and never play the game?
No. And so that's what I'm saying. So I don't watch their videos anymore because I'm not playing it. And it's just mm-hmm. it's a waste of my time. So, but mm-hmm. when I was playing the game, I did get enjoyment out of it, along with it was helpful to because they shared tips. It was a whole little community. So, mm-hmm.
no, I get the community aspect around sports, and it's a skewed community. But like uh-huh. a community with sports, like that's cool and everything. And I definitely, it's not across the board that everybody who watches sports doesn't play sports. I'm sure
but a lot is of a people
wonderful
don't.
Like yeah I know a lot of people, and then I'd say most people who play video games and watch people play video games and vice versa and all the way around. Like there's half a percent of people who watch stuff on Twitch don't play any video games at all. Just turn on YouTube, watch people play video games, and go make ramen I don't think that happens.
I don't understand that.
And so if that sounds weird or like, you know, or makes sense to you that a person wouldn't just watch people play video games and not play the video game itself.
You're saying then that's kind of how
you apply that to sports. And it's the exact same thing. It's like, why would I watch people play?
You know what
play?
I think also, and look at me rallying for the sports people, and I'm not even into them. Sports people, all you sports listeners, I'm speaking for y'all today. But you know what? I think also it's not just the fact that, it's not just the aspect of like, oh, I play sports, so I want to watch it. It's like sports all around the world are like, that's a part of society.
Right.
So from colleges to high school, you have your team mascot and the thing. And that's just a thing to do, to go to the games and with your friends. Yeah.
But that's in grade school. I mean, we all know you went to a different experience, but in my elementary school, that was a talk in the lunchroom with the guys' table. Like, you'd come back Monday, you'd talk about, it was like Monday night football. So on Tuesday, we'd be talking about whatever. And it's like, I that's a conversation I was never previewed to. We'd be over in the nerd section talking about other stuff.
Yeah.
But basically, it is part of society. And it's like, I get it. It's an easy way to connect. It's an easy way to have friends based on something that you all
and that's what I mean by, say, like a part of society, and this, that like it's an easy community in of like, oh, you like this team, I like this team. Mm-hmm. You like this sport, I like this sport. Also, sports is so because I was going to say, like, so for like a musician, like there's a community for people who love music. But then you could say that like music is controversial in a sense, like there's certain music that is acceptable in every kind of space. And then there's other music that's like, oh no, like you, like nobody's playing heavy metal at the family cookout, whether you white or black. And so like,
I just picture that, and I'm like, there's at least one.
There's one. Oh,
and
yes, there's always an exception.
Imagine that cookout. That cookout.
No seasoning.
No seasoning. But it's those guys who play the pretend sword thing by the field where, remember? Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
those
yeah.
people, and they go to their house, and they play metal, and they're having no seasoned chicken at the cookout.
It's just hot dogs and ketchup, which I love ketchup, but that's it. But my point is just that, you know, some people might say, oh, well, this certain kind of music is what's the word they use?
Controversial.
Controversial, or like, this isn't family friendly. So it's not as easy of a community in as sports is, because sports is just family friendly. Everybody can watch, everybody can participate, everybody can do it, yada, yada, yada. So, it's an easy end. But I would like to tell you all a story. For the first time in my life, again, I don't watch the Olympics and I don't really care about them. But shout out to everybody who's doing their thing, because the people work really hard to get to where they are, and they're doing things that I can never do. But I am 3 degrees of separation away from a Olympic gold medalist.
Okay.
Damian Warner of London, Ontario. He won the Olympic gold medal for decathlon, and my friend who lives in London, Canada, worked with his mom. Hmm. But like, I think they still work in the same, they work together. So
the story's fantastic.
Right. So,
so many details, Caleb.
Exactly.
Slow down.
Yeah. So shout out to Logan. He told me that yesterday. And he was like, I'm like 1 degree away from an Olympic gold. I'm like, that makes me. Is it 2 degrees or 3 degrees? Because it's just two people. So I guess it's 2 degrees.
Maybe it's 2 degrees. I never know about it. There's like,
because it's just my friend and then Damien's mom. So I'm 2 degrees away from him. Is that how it works? Or am I three? Because anyways, you know, I'm close. I'm
close. You got to call up my fifth grade math teacher. We'll see about it.
So shout out to Damien and congrats on your gold medal.
I'm not going to lie that the prestige that you get, and especially after your lifetime of work, I mean, lifetime to these people is very short mm-hmm. because they've only been trained like lifetime. It's not 40, 50 years. It's like 15 years. Like, you know, that's could be the lifetime from 0 to 15 and then they're in the Olympics. Like that's their lifetime. So, but still, you know, it's what they've been doing. It's what they want to do sometimes. And to get that prestige is obviously amazing for a winner to prove. And it's not only that. I think it's getting the gold medal and then crushing the records. Every year is about crushing records.
This guy, Damien, I don't really know. Okay, so after winning an Olympic record of 9,018 points, he became one of only four athletes who have ever recorded over 9,000 points over the 10 events. I don't know what that means, but he set a record. So plus
it's a decathlon, which means, and be surprised that I know this. I just know random pieces of information. This is just random. I don't know anything about sports. I just know this random piece. So the only thing I know about sports, but decathlon, 10 deca. So it's 10 things they got to do. And it's like, it's like they got to run here, swim there, shoot something, you know, like it's just a bunch of things they got to do one after the other. Gotcha. And so each one I'm sure has a score. Yeah. So at the end they can find out who's the real winner. It's not about just getting at the end, you know, it's like,
yeah.
Get at the end. Sure. But then like, let's see what you did.
The point. Yeah. How did you, so how good you did? Well, yeah, he is one of four that has scored over 9,000 points. So
I'm pretty sure one of them is shooting something.
Like a bow
like they
and
have
arrow?
To pick up a rifle and shoot some targets in the middle of their running around, swimming.
You know, I don't know.
Get into a car, Fast and Furious. Like, I don't know what. That, to me, would be a wonderful show. Like, it's just action-adventure pieces. Like, how good you can drive a car, how good you can jump off a building, how good you can, like, throw yourself down some stairs, shoot some guns. Anyways, yeah. Like,
so I just wanted to say, to your point, America would love that. I get to shoot guns. Mm-hmm. But anyways, I will say, you know, a little earlier when you're just talking about how they train for all these years or whatever, and it's like their lifetime. I will say there is something really cool, and the Olympics is a much more of a step up than just your average football game, because you are competing with people from around the world. So this isn't just like, oh, the hometown. It's like, oh, if you've made it here, then you're doing pretty good. So, I mean, that is cool.
So they don't shoot anything, but they do everything like in the track and field. So they do the shot put, the high jump, javelin throw, pole vault, hurdling. They do all this stuff that you see in a track and field. Everything in track and field all at once. Do it now. But I am there is something, maybe it's in the winter games where it's like skiing and shooting. Looks like it's you have to do both. Like, because I saw it in a Bond movie, so that's where I learned things.
Hey.
So anyway, no, it's like, I love the World Series of Baseball. Two countries are involved.
Exactly. Three, maybe,
you know, like but at the same time, which countries are involved is entirely based on money. How much money a country is willing to put into so like Brazil and Argentina, do they win gold medals for the Olympics? I don't know, but I would lean towards they probably don't as much as the United States, as Japan, as other, you know. But who wins World Cup soccer? Fucking Brazil and Argentina. So it's like the monies is very important because Argentina doesn't put monies into... I could be wrong, but this is just an example. Like Argentina could put money into the World Cup, but put next to nothing for the Olympic events, and it'll win anything. So it's really, it's a person's prowess plus the money backed by the country that they're in, and the country decides what they want to, if anything. Like I would say most countries are like, we fucked, like we
well, that's one thing,
other stuff. Well,
that's one thing I was thinking of. I was like, how do you I mean, it's a whole conversation, but like I'm like, how do you decide like who makes the decision of like these are the categories we're going to enter into? Like are we gonna be tennis? Are we going to do the decathlon? Right. Are we going to do the running? Are we going to do the gymnastics? Like,
right?
Who decides? Like,
down to the nitty gritty of this. You know, which sport? You know,
is it fast walkers?
Are we which one are we going to devote our money to? Down to the, are we going to bid to have the Olympics in our country, which is a huge financial commitment? Like Japan is paying right now. For all of this, they've built stuff, they've done all this stuff for these events, and it's not like the International Olympic Committee like refunds them. No, it's just this country is spending all this money. All these other countries are spending the money for their athletes and sending them there, and everything is being paid by countries. And so there is a controversy also, like, maybe not in Japan. Maybe it is. I don't know. But like many times has the Olympic Games been hosted in a country where the inhabitants are like, but we...
Oh, yeah. We that was money. Rio. That was Rio 4 years ago of like, why? Like,
and furthermore, they're like, you can't even come. Like, it's like, we're devoting all this money to this and people in the country can't come because it's too expensive. So like, it's like a double slap.
But not only that, then when the Olympics leaves, they leave all that mess. All these stadiums, things that they... Well, not stadiums, but... what do you call it? Like, they build the all these... Yeah, the infrastructure to host these different sporting events. And that's all just left there. It's not like it becomes something else or it's given now, over, you know,
insanely. Barcelona hosted their games
in 1992, because I'm going to bring that up later.
And I go to that every year, like, because what they set up in Barcelona is like on the waterfront. They built the beach, they built all these things, and I've gone to these places over and over. So, you know, I'm sure countries repurpose it for their own citizens to use afterwards as parks.
Well, I'm sure it depends on which country, because I definitely remember reading an article like 4 years ago where it was showing all this Olympic stuff, and it's like, you know, plants have grown up all over everything, and it's just left there wasted. So that, I think that is good. That's great that Barcelona did that and, you know, made it into something to make it useful, but that doesn't always happen.
Yeah, because that requires like money and planning decades into the future. It's like, you got to plan for the now, and then how is this going to be accessible?
I don't even give them that excuse, because if as you're planning for the Olympics, then you can plan like, so what are we going to do after this is over? Like, there can be, make a committee to decide who's going to, I mean, yeah, to come up with what's going to be done with this once the games are over.
But all it takes, that does take more money. And so it's kind of like you set up for a party for the party, and you built all this stuff, and as soon as the party is over, you're like, well, I got all these things, but there's no easy way for us to use this anymore beyond this, because you didn't think beyond just getting this set up, and it was kind of like a cut costs. So they cut costs to make this work now and not be viable to be used in the future. Whereas I think maybe Barcelona thought about, okay, we're going to pour money to this.
Barcelona did full party planning, okay?
Yep.
They did full party planning. This is full what's going to happen at the party, and then after the party, this is what's happening. And so that's
and it's been a party at those locations ever since. Like, they have been partying. They have been using those locations. Mm-hmm. And honestly, it just boils down to how much respect do they have for their citizens? Like,
yeah,
we're building this for this thing, but it's in our state.
Mm-hmm.
And our people here are basically funding this. But basically, they are. These are government funds out of taxes, building this thing. And if you don't think about your people, it's just... But I am going to get into how the Olympics don't care about you.
Let's get into it. I'm ready to be educated and learn all about it.
Learn all about it. As per usual, I've got loads of articles. So BuzzFeedNews.com, Olympics.com, CPR.org, and that's Colorado Public Radio.
I was like, CPR?
There's a CPR.com. It's not as good as you think it would be. Like, you know, if like, mm-hmm. CPR.com, there should be like instant diagrams of what to do, you know, because like, if you were going to be an idiot and just go CPR.com, how do you do this? It's not readily available. I'm like, girl, you should up the... And CPR.org should have a link mm-hmm. at the top.
Just in case you came to the wrong place.
Exactly.
Let's redirect you.
Mm-hmm. But no, that's Colorado Public Radio.
Right.
Britannica.com, History.com, Nature.com, TheGuardian.com, USAToday.com, NewYorkTimes.com, and Wikipedia. Always Wikipedia.
Wiki.
10 days after fencer Alan Hadzik secured a spot as an alternate on the U.S. Olympic team, a group of women took their concerns about him straight to the top. The six women fencers, including two Olympic athletes, wrote to the Olympic Committee that Alan Hadzik should not be allowed to represent the U.S. because he was under investigation for at least three accusations of sexual misconduct reported to the U.S. Center for Safe Sport, a nonprofit agency responsible for protecting athletes from abuse. His presence at the Olympic Games, they said, was a direct affront to fellow athletes and put them at risk.
Mm-hmm.
Alan Hadzik is now one of the 24 Olympic fencers in Tokyo, an exclusive spot at the pinnacle of his sport, and obviously to the dismay of his teammates. Though last month, Safe Sport had suspended Alan Hadzik from the international competition, the 29-year-old from New Jersey fought to get that prohibition lifted and ultimately was able to participate in the Summer Games. Acknowledging the severity of the allegations facing Alan Hadzik, the USA Fencing, the athletic federation in charge of selecting the country's Olympic competitors, created a safety plan to keep him away from women and away from the Olympic Village. Flew in on a separate plane. He's staying at a hotel 30 minutes away from other athletes. He won't be allowed to practice alongside female athletes. This is what their safety plan is. And all I have to say is the fuck.
Yeah, like, it's not just the teammate's safety. It's, if he has a history of this, it's any woman he's in contact with.
Imagine some dude is accused of sexual misconduct at your workplace. And instead of like any real consequences, he's given his own office on another floor, his own bathroom. It's like, that's the response.
Yeah.
But don't worry. It gets worse. he appealed the conditions. The entire roster of Team USA fencers signed a letter demanding the restrictions stay in place. But this is even the point. I mean, like, as you said, he shouldn't be competing at all. quote, "We are pissed off that this is even a thing we had to deal with," said an Olympic fencer who filed a complaint against Alan Hadzic alleging predatory behavior. "He's been protected again and again. The Olympics don't care about you." Complaints about Alan's alleged behavior were no secret in the close-knit fencing community. Interviews with 30 current and former USA fencers and officials, including three women who have formally accused Hadzic of sexual misconduct, as well as documentation, show a pattern of alleged sexual misconduct and violent behavior going back to 2010 when he was a student at Columbia University. The question over whether Hadzic would be allowed to compete in Tokyo fell to SafeSport, the agency Congress put in charge of investigating misconduct in Olympic sports in 2018 following revelations that former USA gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar had sexually assaulted scores of athletes. Now, a little bit about Larry Nassar. Get ready.
Buckle up.
The Larry Nassar scandal is the biggest sexual abuse scandal in sports history that we know of. Nassar's victims, who include some of the most famous female athletes around the world today, including Simone Biles, Michaela Maroney, outnumber the alleged victims of Harvey Weinstein and Bill Cosby combined. The abuse was global. He abused girls in London, at the USA Gymnastics Training Center in Texas, at the gymnastic meets in the Netherlands. And aside from the number of girls Larry abused, the most shocking revelation about this case is how the abuse was covered up and for how long it was covered up. Complaints were made to Michigan State University, where Larry worked, as far back as 1998. But no one did anything. An investigation conducted during Nassar's trial revealed a long pattern in the USA gymnastics of hushing up or downplaying complaints about sexual abuse in the sport. Repeatedly, coaches and officials were protected at the expense of athletes. Why? Gymnastics and the US Olympic Committee didn't want to scare off sponsors. They didn't want to risk losing Olympic medals, so they covered it up. And at a certain point, they went so far in the cover-up that they were implicated. So they dug in deeper to protect themselves from criminal and civil liability. Catholic Church much? And let me give you a perspective that's wild. Larry was actively abusing girls in the 90s and 2000s, and I say girls because of the 500 or so known victims, just let that settle in.
Wow.
500. Yeah. The majority of them were not yet born in 1997.
So
if every one of them had been born in 1997, some were born in later in the 2000s, but let's say every one of them had been born in 1997, it would have been 2015 before any of them turned 18. So we're talking about 8, 9, 10-year-olds here.
Yeah.
And in 2016, the FBI found 37,000 images of child pornography in his possession.
Wow.
So no need to get into the details, but the scope of this is wild. I mean, it's... If he had given permission... I'm saying, like, beyond the permission he was already given. Like, if say, like, he had the ability to take these girls to a second location, instead of, like, just his doctor's office or any in the Olympic, murder would have probably ensued. Like, this is... The fact that they're not dead is thankfully something that at least they had because, well, they're important. You know, they're Olympians, you know. But if he had just, you know, these weren't, if it, they had not been Olympians, I think murder would have definitely occurred here, as what I've covered many times before when it comes to child predators.
And so that's what he would do. He would do this when he was like taking them to the this doctor's was like office. Exams.
He was a doctor. He was examining them, and he would do things. Yeah. The Olympics don't care about you.
Why? Okay. Yeah.
Back to Alan Hadzik, the fencer. Three women have formally filed reports this year to Safe Sport, the organization set in place after the Larry scandal, and at least 10 others submitted statements to support their allegations against Alan. But Alan was able to circumvent his suspension and make his way to Tokyo. It's left many athletes, and myself, totally skeptical of Safe Sport's capacity to act decisively on allegations of sexual misconduct. And it's prompt a reckoning on the sexual abuse, harassment, and male entitlement that many say run deep within sports culture. This comes at a time when other Olympic athletes, such as Sha'Carri Richardson, have been barred from competing in the games for testing positive for cannabis. Testing positive for cannabis.
Yeah.
Crazy. Get the fuck out of here. Just get the fuck out of here. Prove to me weed is a performance enhancing drug.
Yeah.
I'll wait.
Yeah.
A quote from one of the competitors. Now we have to deal with the consequences of having a predator on the team while simultaneously competing in the biggest event of our lives. What does Alan have to say about all this? You guessed it. Alan has denied all allegations of sexual misconduct, telling USA Today that they are, quote, their untruths. There's nothing more telling for me that when, like, stupid words are used, you know, that stupid words are, like, conjured up to tell your side of the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a lie or it's a truth. It's exactly. Fact or it's exactly. Fiction. Exactly. These are the words. Like, mm-hmm. It's not fake news. It's not falsehoods. It's not untruths. Yeah. It's not alternative facts. It's just true mm-hmm. or false.
And these are all words and phrases because you know you're lying.
Exactly.
And so instead of, and you, along with knowing you're lying, that means you also know you're not telling the truth.
Yeah.
And so whether they realize what they're doing consciously or not, yeah, that's like their brains trying to be like, okay, well, I can't say it's the truth, so like, and I can't say that I'm lying. It's an untruth. It's alternative facts. It's fake news. It's yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, his attorney, Michael Palma, everybody needs an attorney, folks, told the New York Times that his client had never committed any of the acts of sexual assault. By barring him from staying in the Olympic Village, Palma said USA Fencing was preventing Alan Hadzik from, quote, participating in the Olympic experience that he has rightfully earned. Mm-hmm. Hold the applause. A spokesperson for the U.S. Center for Safe Sports said they could not speak on the case, citing the center's commitment to confidentiality. In statements, both USA Fencing and the USA Olympic and Paralympic Committee said that they don't have the power to determine Alan Hadzik's eligibility. USA Fencing explained that Safe Sport has the exclusive authority in cases involving sexual misconduct and said it does not consider unproven allegations of sexual abuse when determining who qualifies for the Olympic team. So they're passing the blame here, passing it to another authority here. And that's just great, I guess. And again, imagine if your coworkers had as much protection as Alan does. I mean, you work at some 9-to-5 at some corporate office. And so what if Alan is a world-class fencer?
Mm-hmm.
Both of those positions, your petty little office job and a fencing athlete are just as insignificant. Sorry to tell you, but I mean, yes, yeah. Your job is meaningless, but that's just illustrate that you and the Olympian are on the same page. Like, you're both meaningless and should be subjected to the same scrutiny.
Yeah,
you know, your company's net goals, net profit goals, and an Olympian gold medal, it just doesn't matter.
Yeah,
they don't feed the homeless, they don't shelter the poor, they don't save lives, they don't help climate emergency. Columbia University suspended him from campus for a year following sexual misconduct allegations. Allen would ignore the rules of his suspension and would often linger around campus and pop up at parties and hangouts. While suspended at Columbia, Allen would go to other schools to party, including Penn State. Three former Penn State fencers said they saw him at their social events several times, but had no idea he had been suspended and kicked off his university's team.
Wow.
After a year of suspension and being expelled from fencing, he was able to return and complete his degree at Columbia. While he pursued his degree, he was also able to continue fencing at a national level, earning silver at a North American Cup in December of 2013 and competing at four other high-level tournaments that following year. He was known as being a freak athlete with a long reach and small repertoire of masterful moves, which enabled him to close fast and attack opponents before they blink. The lack of lasting repercussions for Allen made it crystal clear how institutions and coaches handled complaints about their male peers. A quote from a female competitor: "He made my life a living hell at Columbia because he was extremely emotionally and psychologically abusive. At the same time, nothing could be done. We were all so helpless in the situation because he just continues to get what he wants because he's a really fantastic fencer." When Allen began his athletic career, the USA Fencing Board of Directors served as something like a kind of a Supreme Court for cases of misconduct and would institute bans ranging anywhere from 2 years to life for serious violations. Among the members of that board was Michael Offrichtig. Butchered. Michael had been Allen's coach at Columbia. Okay, here? So here's the Supreme Court. We got Michael, who had been Allen's coach at Columbia. Here was the opportunity. Here's where it could have stopped.
Yeah.
Allen was banned from representing Columbia. He wasn't banned from fencing at large. Three members who served on the board said that Allen's disciplinary record was never brought to their attention.
So that's just a blatant lie. Yep. If
it's like straight up an omission. It was like, you know, 100% Michael Aufrichtig knew.
Yeah.
That Allen was suspended, that there was all this stuff.
Lie. Yeah.
You would just, you're coach on the board for approving him. You would think you would mention, hey, dude, he was suspended from Columbia for sexual harassment.
Mm-hmm.
And that maybe should have led to further, but no, he admitted it, he lied, and they went on and approved. So after college, Allen took a break from fencing. After falling short of making the 2016 Olympic team, he worked and studied in Belgium before deciding in 2018 to dedicate himself full-time to making the 2020 Olympic roster. By that time, the revelation of sexual assault committed by Larry Nassar had, quote-unquote, changed the way Olympic sports handled reports of abuse, taking investigations out of the hands of athletic federations, incentivized to protect their stars. But sure, okay. To another organization.
Yeah.
Probably also incentivized to protect their stars. In May 2021, Allen reached number 4 in ranking amongst U.S. fencers, good enough to qualify as an alternate for the Olympics, bringing his former teammates to the realization that there was a chance he'd end up securing a spot coveted by hundreds of fencers. Just about any aspiring fencer would sell their souls to have it, said a former Olympic coach. When USA Fencing announced Hadzik's selection to the team on Instagram with an image of him giving a thumbs up in celebration, some of his former teammates, including former Colombian captain Katie Angen, Columbia University captain, not like she's from Columbia, Columbia University captain Katie Angen, she shared and commented on the post with outrage, calling out USA Fencing for supporting a predator. She said, quote, "It's disgusting that U.S. fencing lets someone who actively preys on drunk and sober women represent our country." And what did USA Fencing do? Let's see. Option A, they reversed their decision and chose another candidate. B, took it upon themselves to investigate and get to the bottom of it. C, quickly disabled comments on its Instagram post.
Disable comments. C for 100, Alec.
Yep. Katie Angen and two other women then filed complaints against Allen with Safe Sport. But as weeks went by and the 2021 Summer Games approached, the fencers feared investigation was going to move too slowly. So on May 20, Katie and a group of the USA fencers, including two Olympians, emailed the U.S. Olympic Committee expressing their deep concern about Allen's potential presence in Tokyo. A few days later, the Olympic Committee replied with a list of available mental health services, including a subscription to the meditation app called Headspace.
What?
That was their only response, Katie said. It was unbelievable. On June 2nd, Safe Sport finally suspended Allen due to the ongoing investigation, preventing him from participating at the Olympics. But afterwards, Allen pushed for an arbitration hearing on June 28th. What's an arbitration hearing? An arbitration hearing is similar to small claims court. The participants present evidence and make arguments supporting their decisions. After the hearing, the arbitrator decides in favor of one side or the other. So basically, Allen took it to Judge Judy. And Judge Judy, not the real Judge Judy, sided with him, lifting his suspension until the final investigative report was complete. So Allen, an economically stable white male, was again allowed to circumvent justice and go to the Tokyo Games. But don't worry, he wasn't on the same flight as his teammates, and he was sequestered from other athletes at the game, so all good, no big deal. To many in the fencing community, Allen's case is only the most high-profile example of a broader problem stemming from a sense of entitlement amongst many athletes and officials and of Safe Sport's inability to police the sport. Quote, "It's a systemic culture of rich white males," said Essene Waters, or SN Waters, who has spent more than a decade as a fencer and a referee. In interviews, 30 fencers, coaches, and referees described a climate in which some athletes say they've been told to sit on a coach's lap, have been groped in hotel elevators at tournaments, or threatened with violence if they didn't engage in sexual acts. A female coach at the University of North Carolina filed a civil suit last year alleging that a male assistant coach at Penn State groped her in view of other athletes on a flight from a fencing tournament. A survey of women fencers conducted in 2018 found that of the 218 respondents, 129 said that they had been sexually harassed by other members of the fencing community. 41 of those respondents said they'd been sexually assaulted by someone within the sport. Wow. Yet, only 3 have been reported to Safe Sport. Much of the hesitancy to report to Safe Sport is due to what dozens of athletes describe as the center's spotty reputation in the fencing community, and I'm sure in any other community. Safe Sport is a joke, said a male fencer. I have no faith in Safe Sport. Another woman fencer said she filed a complaint after a male referee had repeatedly stalked her. One night after a tournament, he cornered her in a bar, threatened to kill her dog if she didn't have sex with him. Months later, the man pressured her hotel roommate into giving him a copy of their room key. Another person intervened before the man could harm her. She reported this. She reported it to Safe Sport in 2019. She was just shuffled amongst 3 different investigators, yet none of her witnesses that she had submitted for the investigation were contacted.
So Safe Sport is a joke and is no point for it.
She summarized the experience with Safe Sport in one word: horrible. Essen Waters, that referee and fencer, she also said she filed a Safe Sport complaint in January 2018 after a coach at her club asked her to sit on his lap. God, what is this sitting on? What are we? Santa, you get the one rein here, okay? And that's with full on parent supervision. Like, and your kid wanting to do it. Like, yeah, all those things. Okay, sit on his lap. Other than that, girl. Anyways, the coach at her club asked her to sit on his lap, then started moving his hand from her hip to her breast. The investigation concluded that he didn't violate Safe Sport code, but when Waters received the investigative report, she found that the basic facts in it were wrong. The investigator wrote that Waters had left the club in part because she wanted to follow her boyfriend. Waters didn't have a boyfriend at the time. I couldn't even finish reading it, Waters said of the report. Safe Sport declined to comment on specific cases, citing confidentiality policies. The Olympics don't care about you. So let's take a breath. That was a lot of information. Let's breathe in. Let's breathe out. Let's digest this because it's only going to get worse, y'all. All right. Let's go back in time and really drive this home. 1968, the Olympic Games in Mexico City. Yes. No. These games were the most politically charged Olympics since the 1936 games in Berlin. One could imagine. 10 days before the games were to open in Mexico, 10,000 students protesting the Mexican government's use of funds for the Olympics rather than for social programs were surrounded at the Plaza de las Tres Culturas by the Mexican army and fired upon.
Wow.
Hundreds of protesters were killed. Estimates are at 300 to 400 dead and over 1,000 injured. This alone would have been enough for me to cancel the whole games. You kill hundreds of people, you're done.
For no reason.
Done. Don't care about the work you put in. Sorry. People are dead now. Wow. But the games went on. At the victory ceremony for the men's 200-meter run, USA athletes Tommy Smith and John Carlos, gold and bronze medalists respectively, stood barefoot, each with one head bowed and a single black-gloved fist raised during the national anthem. The athletes described the gesture as a tribute to their African-American heritage and a protest of the living conditions of minorities in the United States. It didn't get better, y'all. Didn't get better. Officials from the International Olympic Committee and the U.S. Olympic Committee judged the display to be counter to the ideals of the games. Keep in mind that only a couple of weeks prior to this, hundreds of people were shot in the streets. Thousands were still in the hospital. Moms and dads were still burying their kids. Both athletes were banned from the Olympic Village and sent home.
Also, I don't know if you're going to get into it, but the white guy who got this, I'm guessing the silver, since he got gold and bronze, he also, he didn't put his fist in the air, but he, I don't know, I feel bad I'm telling the story wrong, but he had like a pen or something that he showed like solidarity with them, and he was basically like stripped of everything and when he went back to Australia and pretty much ostracized for a while, because he didn't raise his fist with them, but he was in solidarity with him. And he, a lot of times, I'm just mentioning him because a lot of times he gets
Why did swept you under the too?
Well, not only that, he just gets swept under the rug, like, because people just remember them, which they should, because they were the ones, you know, actively protesting in a physical way. But he was with them, and you know, he just kind of gets forgotten. So,
and this is 68, decades before Colin, and.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing has changed.
Not
both
thing.
These groups of people, modern football players and these Olympians back in the day, and I'm sure decades prior to this and throughout all time, will protest in the most innocuous way, in the most just a very solemn way of protesting. And it's just like met with just everything that you would imagine would be met with 400 dead Mexicans. Like that's what I would, oh my God, like that level of like, oh, I cannot believe what, no. Black people die in the streets. No, but you kneel. Oh God. Anyway, that's. So
because people don't want, and it's such a, it's such a show of the those running these events and heading up these corporations that fund these events. It shows their character that they care more about, one, just making money and keeping the focus on just the entertainment factor, despite the fact that what the individuals are protesting is like a humanity issue and something that everyone should be on board with. It shouldn't be a problem to bring this up. Like that shows their character that they're trying to suppress that and make it and demonize that, really is what they're doing, as if that's something wrong and we should ignore it.
Honestly, to me, you should be able to protest anything as long as it's nonviolent. At any time.
Yeah.
At any time, anywhere, you should be able to protest anything for any reason, as long as it's nonviolent. I mean, just saying, this is the general thing.
Yeah.
I understand violence can happen and everything, but it is just mind-blowing when, see, I could protest the fact that Popeyes doesn't have spicy chicken nuggets, and I should be able to protest anywhere. Mm-hmm. But if you're protesting something that's so in the collective trauma sphere of everyone, you know, like the world, even more so should you be allowed to do it. You should be allowed to do, again, like I said, you should be allowed to protest anything at any time as long as it's nonviolent. And if you're protesting something that's like, whoa, like something really important that involves a lot of people other than yourself, that should be commended.
I was going to say, because that's what it is. It's not about you not being able to protest. It's that you should not be, you should not face, you know,
backlash,
some sort of backlash or disciplinary action for doing something that is right, that is bringing awareness to an injustice or something that is wrong. There should be no, there shouldn't be a harmful consequence. When I say harmful, losing your job, you know, somehow, you know, they're destroying your reputation. That shouldn't happen. That's what the issue is. Because it's like, oh yeah, they're fine. You want to protest? Well, we're going to destroy your livelihood.
Yep.
And that's the, yeah, that's the issue.
The 1968 Games were the first to institute drug testing. And get ready, y'all, female gender verification. The rationale was to prevent masquerading males and women with unfair male-like physical advantage from competing in female-only events. Visual observation and gynecological examination had been tried on a trial basis for 2 years at some competitions leading up to the 68 Olympic Games, but these invasive and demeaning processes were dropped in favor of laboratory-based genetic tests. Like, it's even better, but okay. Despite compelling evidence for the lack of scientific merit for screening for gender, as well as its functional and ethical inconsistencies, the International Olympic Committee persisted in its policy for 30 years. In 1990, the International Amateur Athletics Federation called for an abandonment of required genetic screening of women athletes, and by 1992 had adopted a fair, medically justifiable model for preventing male imposters in the international track and field. In 1999, the International Olympic Committee finally ratified the abandonment of on-site genetic screening of females. The Olympics don't care about you at all, ladies and gentlemen.
Crazy.
Neither or both. The 1972 Munich Games marked the first return of the Olympics to Germany since the 36 Games in Berlin. And the specter of the 1968 Mexico City Olympics loomed. And Munich organizers decided on spending less than $2 million on security, and security personnel were to be unarmed, inconspicuous, and non-confrontational. So before I get into all of it, I get their logic here. Germany had been Germany, and Mexico happened. So they were like, let's just tone down security. But this didn't end up being good either. The games began on August 26th, 1972. And for more than a week, the games unfolded without incident. All cool, all chill. The Day of Terror began at 4:30 a.m. on September 5th, 1972, when eight Palestinian militants affiliated with Black September, a militant offshoot of the Palestinian group Fatah, scaled a fence surrounding the Olympic Village in Munich. Disguised as athletes and using stolen keys, they forced their way into the quarters of Israeli Olympic team. As they attempted to enter the first apartment, apartment one, they were confronted by Josef Gutfreund, a wrestling referee, and Moshe Weinberg, a wrestling coach. Weinberg was shot while fighting with the attackers, who forced him at gunpoint to lead them to the rooms of the remaining Israeli coaches and athletes. It has been proposed that Weinberg led the attackers past apartment two, which was also being used by the Israeli team, because he believed that the wrestlers and the weightlifters in apartment three would be better able to fight back. However, Black September had detailed plans of the Olympic Village, and they knew where they knew where everyone was. Shaul Ladany, a race walker who survived the attack after escaping from apartment two, suggests that it was much more likely that this room was bypassed because it was also housed with members of the Israeli shooting team. So, I mean, the terrorists had kind of a struggle to subdue men from apartment one, and they were like, okay, we're gonna go into apartment two because there's like world class marksmen in that room, so we're gonna go to apartment three and continue the operation. Apartment three, the terrorists gathered more hostages and forced them back to apartment one. Wrestler Gad Sabari broke from the group, dashed down a flight of stairs towards an underground parking garage, and Weinberg took advantage of the confusion to fight with the attackers. Weinberg had nearly gained control of a terrorist's gun when he was shot and killed. And this one competitor, Josef Romano, he was on crutches, but he was a weightlifter, strong man. He attempted to disarm one of the terrorists, but he was killed and his body was left on the floor of apartment one as a warning. While two Israelis lay dead in the Olympic Village, nine others were being held hostage. International Olympic Committee chairman Avery Brundage insisted that the games must continue. The Olympics don't care about you.
What in the world?
The terrorists demanded the liberation of more than 200 Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. And what I was going to say is that this is the article. They're terrorists, yes. They're killing people, yes. But I've talked about Israel and Palestine, so this is more complex. You know, this is freaking centuries of problems, and this is just one pimple zit, you know, of these issues, something that has manifested. The release, so they demanded 200 Palestinians held in Israeli prisons to be released. They demanded the release of Andreas Bader and Ulrich Meinhof of the Red Army faction. They were in German prisons. And for an airplane to fly them to a safe destination in the Middle East. While negotiations were ongoing, a planned rescue attempt had been called off when it was realized that the actions of West German police were being broadcast live to nearly 1 billion people around the world and many televisions throughout the Olympic Village. Shouldn't have, but hey. At about 10 p.m. on September 5th, believing they had reached an agreement, the terrorists led their bound and blindfolded hostages from their quarters into buses and then into waiting helicopters. The helicopters flew and carried them to Fürstenfeldbruck Air Base, 15 miles west of the Olympic Village, where police were lying in ambush. Kind of. Although the German army had better training here and equipment for such a mission, this was post-war Germany and armed forces were forbidden in aiding civilian police because of Nazis. Okay. But police snipers used in the operation had not received formal training as sharpshooters. They were improperly placed and inadequate in number, and they lacked radios to communicate with each other. In addition, they were armed with assault rifles rather than sniper rifles, and their weapons had neither long-range scopes or night vision. So anybody who has ever played a first-person shooter game can concur that if you do not have a long-range scope, you do not have a sniper rifle. And an assault rifle is a terrible weapon to use as trying to expertly hit somebody on the head and avoid collateral damage, like the worst. On the airbase tarmac was a Boeing 727 filled with 17 police officers disguised as Lufthansa flight crew. It was intended that these officers would subdue the terrorists once they boarded the plane, but the police unanimously chose to abandon their posts. Fuck if I know why. Could have looked into it, but this whole thing is a mess, so this is just part of the mess. Armored cars that were to have aided the rescue here were dispatched too little too late, and they were stuck in traffic. So there was just failures mm-hmm. all around. Planning, execution, mm-hmm. and the result was a disaster. The helicopters arrived at 10:30 p.m. Two terrorists went to inspect the jet. They found it empty. They were like, oh shit, it's a deception. They shouted to their comrades, at which point German police fired upon them. A gun battle ensued, and several terrorists and one police officer were killed. The helicopter flight crews ran for cover, but the Israeli athletes were bound together and trapped. The terrorists also shot out the floodlights that had been illuminating the tarmac. The scene then just settled into a tense, dark stalemate, punctuated by gunfire. Onlookers surrounded the airfield, and sportscaster Jim McKay, who was anchoring the Olympic Village coverage for the U.S. network on ABC, he provided television viewers with preliminary updates. At midnight, a German official announced that all the hostages had been freed and all the terrorists had been killed, a report that proved to be tragically premature, because just after midnight, a terrorist tossed a hand grenade into one of the helicopters, killing all of the hostages on board. A second terrorist sprayed the interior of the other helicopter with bullets at close range, murdering the remaining five Israelis. Too late to aid in the rescue effort, the armored cars finally got to the runway, but their crews had no knowledge of the deployment of the police personnel in the field and no way to communicate with them. So a gunman ran towards the position to where the helicopter pilots were, and a police sniper had taken cover. The terrorist was shot, killed by the sniper, but the movement in the darkened runway drew fire from the armored cars, and both the pilot and the sniper were seriously wounded by friendly fire. Shit show. By midnight 30 on September 6, the shooting has stopped, and the 20-hour reign of terror was over. 11 Israelis had been killed, along with one Munich policeman, and five Black September terrorists lay dead. Three of the gunmen were captured, and at 3 a.m., McKay, the sportscaster, the guy who had been kind of on ABC News, who had been broadcasting on from the Olympic Village for 14 straight hours, summarized the tragic outcome of the botched rescue with the words, "They're all gone." For the first time in history, the Olympic Games were suspended for a measly 24 hours in tribute to the murdered athletes. At a memorial service on September 6th, Brundage, the piece of shit head of IOC, International Olympic Committee, announced that the Games would continue. The Olympics don't care about you. Nominated for five Oscars, Steven Spielberg's 2000 film Munich is based on this and the Israeli government's secret retaliation against the Palestinian Liberation Organization after the Munich massacre. So this story continues. Doesn't end here, and it's in that movie. It's a good watch. I watched it back in 2005. It's dramatic. And Spielberg does depict the massacre at the tarmac in the movie. I'll give it a rewatch soon. And that, ladies and gentlemen, neither, either, both, is why I do not believe that the International Olympic Committee, Safe Sport, or any organization tasked to govern sports cares about you or its players. Every televised sport is a money-making scheme, and often at the expense of very, very young people. I say, if you love sports, play. Gather your friends and family and play. Nothing's wrong with that. Absolutely nothing is wrong with that. When you involve money, sponsors, governments, gender verification, nationalism, do or die for gold medals, Well, it's no longer about the sport.
Yeah. Wow. Again, it's crazy that the... It just shows the character of these people in charge. That, yeah, they don't... Which, I mean, so many people have this problem. So many people in leadership positions, and I need to be specific. So many people in leadership positions have this problem of, yeah, not caring more about material and monetary things rather than just the humanity of people, which is sad. But yeah, we've been seeing this for years and years and years and years and years and years. And until something starts to be done about it, and maybe that takes us as the people, you know, making it a thing. Until that day comes, like, it's going to continue to happen because, yeah, we live in a society and in a world, really, where money runs everything. Mm-hmm. So
I wanted to make it very clear that, you know, because when I was a kid, the Olympics always meant good, pure, the celebration of humanity.
Well, and that's but, the face.
I mean, that's the face.
That's what that's the face they're trying to save. Is right. That this is, look, this family event, and everybody's competing from all around the world, and we're all one and at peace. And
I didn't know any better. I mean, like, mm-hmm. as a kid, obviously, and the Olympics came to the U.S. in the 90s, so there was like,
yeah, it was one Atlanta, of those, Georgia, and
right, exactly.
And 96. That was huge,
and I remember like people buying TVs left or right for this thing. Like I remember like us going to the store, and we were like seeing the intro and these like big TVs. Anyways, there was like TV frenzy.
mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to make it very clear that, and this is just a small samples of how, no, not at all.
Mm-hmm.
Not even close. Not even a little bit.
Yeah.
In many ways. And many of games in the past, and not just for this. Kind of, and that's why I kept repeating over and over, they don't care about you.
Yeah.
Little girls being sexually harassed or touched or raped, you'd think that would spawn change. That would mm-hmm. make waves. Like just
anything that
killing 400 people out in the middle, you know, right? You'd think that.
But anything that's going to jeopardize their flow of income and monetary gain,
right?
They're going to sweep under the rug. They're going to try and hide. Yep. They're going to try and push to the side. They're going to try and it's like if you had a big gash, they're just like, no, let's just put a Band-Aid over it. Like, no need to call the ambulance and get all these other people involved. Like, just put a Band-Aid over it and sit in the corner. Yeah, it's sad that that's the world
and,
that we live in.
This just doesn't only apply to the Olympics. This applies to, like I said, every single televised game, every single sport that's televised has these same problems.
Yeah.
Money-making scheme plus abuse of youth.
Yeah. And I mean, in a lot of cases, this isn't just youth. This is you, but it's also adult. It's just people in general.
Well, yeah. But I think it's like, but abuse of people is terrible, but like abuse of children.
Geez. Yeah.
I don't just mean sexual abuse. I mean, it's mm-hmm. all sorts of abuse and pressure and everything to an outcome that may or may not benefit the youth. in question or anybody other than up here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is there any difference between the kind of the barbaric version of the Olympics of back in the day of thousands of years ago, or like throwing them into fight with lions? Like,
mm-hmm.
No. There's like, yeah, they don't fight lions now, but like, there's other things they have to deal with and other tragedies that will happen, and some even more sinister than that. Like,
yeah.
So, I don't have a solution, y'all. I just bring an awareness. Hope you just get this into your head, because that is one more person that knows about it. That's all.
Yeah, and it's not like the Olympics in and of themselves are bad. It's the people upholding the bad behavior. Mm. Or just putting, again, in the case of that incident in 1972, putting, you know, monetary gain and outward, how do you say, like the spectacle, acting as if that's more important than these issues of humanity. You know, same can be said about the incident in 1968. And
I didn't mention it, but I'm also going to say, again, 400 people died.
Yeah.
Mexicans died. Yeah. 11 Jews died, and now we stopped the games. Mm-hmm. I'm not like trying to, but it's I love to give all sorts of perspectives. And
yeah,
11 white people died, and you stopped the games. 400 mixed brown people die.
Yeah.
You don't even pause the games. You don't delay. You don't moment of silent, nothing. It's just the games must continue. This show must go on. Dude, that only applies to theater. And I swear, if somebody like got injured in a theater production or got died in the audience, we're stopping the show.
Yeah.
The show is done. Like, we're not going to throw on a whole performance and somebody died in the audience. Like, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're forcing, because an athlete would have to make that decision, and they've made this decision, I'm sure, countless times. This tragedy happened, but I have spent my whole life preparing for this. They didn't stop the game so we can do it next year or delay or anything. It's like, they're not stopping it. What can I do? Quit or go? Mm-hmm. And don't blame any of the athletes for saying, hey, I'm here. All these people just died, but I'm here. I guess I'm going to continue. This is what I'm going to do. It forces them to have to make that kind of really intense decision. It is what it is. It is what it is. Like, that's what we're leaving you with.
The world we live in. Right, it is. how did Bruce Hornsby put it? That's just the way it is.
Da-na-na, 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 da-na-na. I'm ready.
I can't.
I am ready.
Digo just put on sunglasses because I'm about to talk about Stevie Wonder.
What?
For those of you who can't. For those of you who are listening and
did you know he's blind?
I can't. I'm not going to do this. I'm not. Mm-mm.
I mean,
you ain't going to get me in trouble with Stevie, okay? Mr. Wonder, I love you. Okay? Or whoever from Mr. Wonder's camp is listening to this, I love him.
Yeah, me too. But I don't think we'd have Stevie as we have him today if he weren't blind. Like,
I want to mention that we don't have to go into a whole conversation. But like, I was literally just thinking, and I didn't know that I was going to talk about Stevie Wonder today. But I don't like that we live in a day and age where a Stevie Wonder would never be I don't believe. I personally don't believe. Some people may feel otherwise. I personally do not believe we would. We in this day and age, there's a possibility of having a Stevie Wonder become the huge star that Stevie Wonder is, or even a Ray Charles.
No, it's true. Like a less than abled person. I don't know what the correct term.
And it's not even about. It's not even about them being. You know. Less than abled. It's like we just live in such a hyper visual like time right now where it's all just about the look. If you can look the part, you can be mediocre.
Let's say you could hear, see everything, you could do it all, but you're in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're missing an arm. You're missing one eye. Like
it, that's the thing. I even think, you know, the missing an arm or being in a wheelchair is even more drastic than just being blind. And I'm saying just being blind, I don't think that an artist can make that. Even if they were as amazing as Stevie Wonder. I'm gonna get into it. The guy's he's a genius, and I don't just say that, like he's a child prodigy.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't believe that we will ever see anybody if things continue. Like,
you're already got scores of beautiful people, normally abled, who don't make it for racism. For so if you got something else, shit, you know, it's tough. And yeah, let's get into this because I am actually, will you cover like. I am curious, how did he rise to the top? Like, okay.
Well, I'm going to get into a little bit of that. Mm-hmm. So I don't really get into like the details of how he rose to the top, but all right, we're just going to start and then I'll start it as we go. All right. So first off, to the listeners and to Mr. Digo, who's sitting across from me on a computer screen right now. So let's just envision the year is 1992. The Olympics are in Barcelona, Spain. You have to put together an Olympic team of musicians for two categories, vocalist and performers. And you get three artists for each team. So for the listeners, send us a message on Instagram or Twitter, email, DM us, call us, find our information and send us a message and let us know who would be on your Olympic team of musicians. Again, there's two categories. There's the vocalist category and there's the performers category.
Cool. And how many?
Three people for each.
Three teams. Okay, cool. Gotcha.
So again, the year is 1992. For my vocalist, I'm going with Whitney Houston, Stevie Wonder, and Patti LaBelle. If Stevie's not available, we can go with Peebo Bryson because Peebo Bryson is like he's our backup. Even though he could definitely, he's like an honorary part of the team. If you don't know, Peebo Bryson sang A Whole New World.
Really?
But like the actual song, not in the Disney movie. How like Idina Menzel sang that Frozen song, but in the movie it's whoever. I'm sorry. Ignore that because I think Idina Menzel did play actually the voice of that whole character. So that's not a good example. But Peebo Bryson sang A Whole New World with Celine Dion, and that's actually the only Disney song to ever go to number one on the Billboard Hot 100, just as a little throw it out there. So anyways, my vocalist would be Stevie Wonder, Whitney Houston, Patti LaBelle. Performers, number one, Tina Turner. Number two,
like she got the ball and she's playing the entire time. Like the other two ain't doing anything.
Watch her documentary on HBO, man. If you haven't already and you haven't listened to our episode of the podcast, just watch it. But Tina Turner, Prince. And then, even though, you know, I don't dislike this guy, but he is what he is. I got to go with Michael Jackson. If we're putting together the Olympic team to go against other performers in the world, like, we gotta. It's like being in the 90s and not putting Michael Jordan on your team.
To not pick the same people and try not to go head to head with this list. And I'm just like,
oh,
how in the hell am I going to beat these people?
So, by the way, if you're in America and you're listening, then you have to pick American artists.
Okay.
And if you're in the UK,
or wherever you are, pick your own.
Yeah. You're welcome to pick, people from your country. But yeah, I just thought that was interesting. I'm like, yeah, who would we put, you know, if this is like vocalists and we got to go against other vocalists in the world, who are we going to get to represent our country? So those are my picks. You guys DM us, send us some messages, let us know your picks. Mm-hmm. And on the next episode or at some point, we will read them off. And hopefully by the end of my story here, Diego will have his people picked.
maybe
or at least one. Just tell us one of each category. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. All right, so to start things off, a little background on Stevie Wonder. He was born Stevelyn Hardaway Judkins in Magasaw, Michigan on May 13th, 1950. Shout out to the May babies in the house. He was the third of five children born to Lula Mae Hardaway and the second of Hardaway's two children with Calvin Judkins. So he was born 6 weeks premature. And that, along with the fact that the hospital incubator had a very oxygen rich atmosphere, that resulted in what's called retinopathy of prematurity, a condition in which the growth of the eyes is aborted and causes the retinas to detach. So that's how he became blind. In 1961, when he was but despite that, I just thought I have to say, he just immediately took to playing different instruments. He was singing in his the Baptist church. I say Baptist specifically because that's when I was reading his research, they named his specific church. He even though he was blind, he was just picking up musically on things just right away and easy. In 1961, when he was 11, he sang and wrote he sang a song he wrote and composed entitled Lonely Boy to Ronnie White of the Miracles. If you don't know who the Miracles are, that's Smokey Robinson's group. Ronnie White then took Stevie and his mom to audition at Motown for the CEO, Berry Gordy. And after he heard him, he signed him to Motown's Tamla label. But before he signed, producer Clarence Paul gave him the name Little Stevie Wonder. And that's literally how Stevie Wonder became a thing. And for a little while, that was the name that he went by, Little Stevie Wonder. And then around, I want to say, was it like 67 or 68, he just dropped Little and just was going by Stevie Wonder.
Because he wasn't Little anymore.
Exactly. So he was hit or miss when it came to his hits during the early 60s. He had a couple, but nothing, he hadn't really started to take off. But then from 68 to 70, he scored several of his hits, including For Once in My Life and Signed, Sealed, Delivered, I'm Yours. And then throughout the 70s, he just like catapulted into stratosphere. And that's when he recorded his hits like Superstitious and Higher Ground and Isn't She Lovely and Living for the City, I Wish, Sir Duke. These are all coming out and just topping the charts entirely through that decade. Actually, in 1975, at age 25, he won the Grammy Award for Album of the Year 2 years in a row. So in 1974, he won it for Inner Visions. And in 1975, he won it for Fulfillingness First Finale. In 1976, when Paul Simon of Simon and Garfunkel won the Album of the Year Grammy for his album Still Crazy After All These Years, he was noted for saying, quote, "I'd like to thank Stevie Wonder, who didn't make an album this year." Because, yeah, Stevie was just dominating. Also, in the the 70s, it was 76 specifically. Did I say that right? Specifically, it was 1976 when he released his iconic album, Songs in the Key of Life, which many people regard as his just crowning achievement and best body of work. So by the time 1984 rolled around, Stevie Wonder is a household name. He's a powerhouse. He's just huge. But he hadn't released anything since, I think it was 1980. Sorry, I know I shouldn't be saying I think since I did all this research, but it had been a few years. It was 1980, since he had released an album. So again, it's 1984. Gene Wilder, known to many people as Willy Wonka, or maybe that's just me. I know he played in tons of other movies,
but no,
I just
know Willy Wonka.
Willy Wonka.
I know, he's done everything, but I never remember his name, the actor. I'm just like, the Willy Wonka.
I will say, I want to read he has a biography that I heard is really good, so I'd like to read that. So he's working on a movie that became like a passion project for him. It said, titled The Woman in Red, which, if you go watch the trailer, it's such, sometimes I'd laugh because when I hear, there'll be a movie that comes out or a music video or something, and all these moms and people are so upset, and I'm like, you guys lived through the 80s where everything was just allowed. And go watch the trailer for this movie, you'll see what I'm saying, just their how they treated women and how it was like the lines that were said, and this is all in the trailer, I have never seen the movie, but just what was said and what was meant to be funny. It was supposed to come across as comical and kind of whimsical. It's just like, wow.
So also, how in the 80s and 70s a grown man with an underaged boy or girl,
we mean
just that, like, without even getting further into it, nowadays, uh-huh. A grown man. I'm not even getting.
Not even hanging. Exactly. Y'all shouldn't even be the same room. No, that's, and that lasted for even into the 90s. Mm-hmm. But so Gene Wilder's working on this movie, The Woman in Red. Dionne Warwick was putting together the music for the movie, and she suggested getting Stevie to do it. Stevie was working on his own album at the time, but he had been working on it for the last 4 years, and he was just kind of stuck. That album would eventually become In Square Circle, which, if you know his song Part Time Lover, that's what that hit was on that album. And so, he kind of was like, "Hey, I need a break. I need to focus my mind on something else." So he took Dionne up on her offer, and he got to work on the soundtrack. He wrote almost every song on it, and he even had a couple of duets with Dionne. And one of the songs on that album was "I Just Called to Say I Love You." Mm-hmm. So Tom Breen of Stereo Gum writes, "I Just Called to Say I Love You doesn't sound like anything Wonder wrote in 1976. Which I have to pause and say, that's so true, because if you think of songs like Superstition, like what were some of the other ones? Higher Ground, Isn't She Lovely? Like,
it doesn't sound like anything. It doesn't sound like any other thing.
No, it doesn't sound like anything of anything that he previously recorded.
It doesn't. I was like, it doesn't sound like anything. It sounds like a wonderful track. It's really powerful. It doesn't sound like something else. It doesn't sound like anything he's done.
Yeah. If you listen to just anything from the whole decade of the 70s is very funk heavy and live instrumentation. I just call to say I love you is very 80s. And that's what Tom goes on to say. He said, instead, the sound of the song is extremely 80s, built around glassy synths and hard smacking drum machines. Wonder produced the track, and he also sang and played everything on the single himself. The lead and backing vocals, the keyboards, the reel and programmed drums. On the 6-minute album version, Stevie sings along Coda through a vocoder, making himself sound like a particularly sappy alien robot. And a vocoder is like the thing to make you sound like T-Pain, for anybody who's young listening.
Who's T-Pain?
Exactly, right? Literally, that's probably what our young listeners are saying. He goes on to say, lyrically, I just called to say I love you is slight and banal. The conceit of the song is pretty obvious. Stevie Wonder just called to say he loves you. On the verses, he points out that this is, quote, another ordinary day. There's no special occasion attached. It's not Christmas or Valentine's Day or Halloween. Mm-hmm. Tom asked, do people usually call to say I love you on Halloween? Which I have to say, I asked the same question. but hey, maybe. None of this is particularly poetic, and it's also simplistic enough that Wonder didn't bother to write a bridge, but he delivers those words with grace and ease, giving a showcase to one of the all-time great pop voices. Wonder had been playing around with synths since the early days of the technology, and he embraced the 80s production tricks while many of his 80s contemporaries struggled to keep up. I just called to say I love you is thin and sleek, but it's thin and sleek with intention. Wonder's tricks, the digital bass line, the soft blip ripples, the gooey sustain on the main keyboard melody. I like that. The gooey sustain. Okay. Okay, Tom. They're all pretty sharp. Wonder's instantly memorable hook comes out as a long, contented sigh, and he switches his key up enough to keep his low drama song interesting. So I just thought that was a really interesting description of the song. Because, yeah, I knew the song, duh, because everybody just knows the song, but I hadn't heard it in a while. And so when I played it last night when I was preparing everything, I was like, oh yeah, this is definitely just straight up 80s. Actually, it kind of reminds me of, what's the Bee Gees song that I covered, that I talked about? It almost is a little reminiscent of that to me. Oh my goodness, what's that song? I can't think of it. But
Ants, I covered stars.com episodes. Oh, Jesus. Bee Gees. Here we go. Oh, wow. It was back in the day when I didn't put the music down. Oops.
Sorry. I'm looking it up. It's okay. It's okay. We got this. Oh, how deep is your love?
Okay.
That's what I was thinking of. Do, 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 do. Okay. So anyway, it kind of reminded me of that. It has that feel to it. But, anyways, the movie The Woman in Red got really bad reviews, and it didn't do too spectacularly at the box office. On the list of highest grossing films of 1984, The Woman in Red is at number 40, just behind The Muppets in Manhattan and A Nightmare on Elm Street. So, just to give you a little perspective, I wonder what the number one movie was. But I'm pretty sure Purple Rain was at least in the top three, or maybe the top five. I don't know. But while the movie was a bit of a fail, the song was just huge and had incredible success. On October 13th, 1984, it reached the top of three different charts, including the Billboard Hot 100, the Adult Contemporary charts, and the R&B charts, where it stayed at number one at each of those charts for 3 weeks. And in the UK, not only did it go to number one on September 8th, it stayed there for 6 weeks, and it ended its run on October 13th. So while it ended its run in the UK, then shot up to number one here in the States. This marked Stevie's first number one in the UK and his eighth in the US. So along with the song, again, dominating the charts and just being everywhere. It was nominated and won the Oscar in 1985 for Best Original Song. And all five of the nominees that year had been a number one hit. And to this day, that's the only time that's ever happened. So the other contenders were, are you guys ready? Footloose.
Okay.
Was one of them. Let's Hear for the Boy was another. Against All Odds, Take a Look at Me Now was the other. And then, which some people, including Tom Brien of Stereo Gump, says was robbed, Ghostbusters.
Oh, was my God. So,
yeah. Nominated that year. Ray Parker Jr.
Take a look at me. Take a look at me now. I'm in the end of space.
Yeah, I didn't even look up the song. I don't know.
I think that's the one. I'm like,
I don't know. It might be.
Anyways, I think I know all of them so far, which is easy because it's the 80s. Okay.
Yeah. So it beat out
all of...
Yeah, that was like Footloose, Let's Hear for the Boy, Against All Odds, Take a Look at Me Now, and Ghostbusters.
Okay.
Or the other four, yeah, in the category that year. Exactly. Who you gonna call? It won the Oscar that year. And so during his acceptance speech, Stevie said, I would like to accept this award in the name of Nelson Mandela. And so this is 1985. Nelson Mandela is still in jail. Mm-hmm. He's been jailed since 1962 because mm-hmm. he's an enemy of the state because of, you know, apartheid going on there. And so the day after the Oscars, the day after he gave that speech, the South African Broadcasting Corporation banned all of Stevie Wonder's music from the radio. Christ. So, yeah. So while the song is in no way political, you know, because Stevie Wonder was a very vocal artist in the fight against apartheid at that time. They were just like, we don't like you. Mm. And he was vocal up until, you know, Mandela was released. I think, was that?
I don't know.
That was the 90s.
Yeah, it was the 90s. I don't know.
Because he even has a song on the album In Square Circle. I'm pretty sure it's In Square Circle. In Square Circle, that's called It's Wrong, Apartheid. So he had a whole song about it as well. In October of 1985, the songwriters Lloyd Chiat and Lee Garrett sued Stevie Wonder, claiming they wrote a song called Hello, It's Me, I Just Called to Say in September 1976 that they played for Wonder, who stole the title and chorus idea. In his testimony, Wonder claimed he wrote the chorus to I Just Called to Say I Love You on July 16th, 1976, while returning home from a visit to his mother. Garrett, who co-wrote Stevie's song Sign Still Delivered, I'm Yours, was a childhood friend of his. He dropped out of the lawsuit on May 7th, 1986, but Lloyd Chiat kept going. And in 1990, a jury ruled in favor of Stevie. And in 1992, Chiat lost an appeal as well. So, and there also was a little worry at the time that the Oscar was going to be taken away because it's given to the writers of the song. But since he won, mm-hmm. you know, he kept the Oscar and everything was fine. So, you know, I was reading that and I was just like, wow, like it's easy, I can't lie, it's easy to be like, nah, we going with Stevie wrote that, but then it's like, you know, I won't go so far as to say like he stole it, but it's very much a possibility that yeah, maybe they did have this song and it was very similar, and you know, he might have started writing this song before, you know, in July, and then once they played them, you know, their version in September, you know, he pulled little things from there.
Again, we talked about this before, like there's much more than just the lyrics or just something to a song. I'm mm-hmm. pretty sure those two songs are drastically different.
Well, not only that, but also I was gonna say it's happened to me, and that's why I know it's a thing. And I don't know if you want to call it like an anomaly or what, but creatives, two completely different creatives that have never met, have never seen each other, can have the same idea. And even down to when it comes to music, the same kind of sound. Like, I will never forget, and I'm not going after these artists. There's a gospel group, and they had this song called Holla. And I guess I had to have been like, I don't know when this was. So I had to have been like 12 or 13. And I wrote this song called Holla. And I remember I sang it to my aunt, who passed away earlier this year. Rest in peace, auntie. And I sang that to her over the phone. And then I don't know if it was a few weeks later, or it definitely was, because it was, so it had to have been like a few weeks later, maybe like a month, maybe two, they came out with this song. And even my childhood friend at the time, you know, I would say like, they took my song, like that was my song. And, you know, he was at the time for like 12, 13. He's like, whatever, they didn't steal your song. But I will never forget, my aunt called me and was like, I just heard this song on the radio and it sounds just like your song. And I was like, I know, I wrote a song that, you know, it was just like the it was the chorus that was very, very similar. Mm-hmm. And so, again, I use that to say that it's very possible mm-hmm. to think of something and someone else think of something that's very similar.
Especially around the same time. Because you're all listening to the same stuff on the radio, listening to the same
thing.
And
again, my aunt is a grown woman with completely coherent. So I say that to say that, like, I know, oh, this wasn't me just being a kid mm-hmm. and thinking, like, it was like, oh, yeah, somebody, I sang this or heard this on the phone a cappella, and then she hears their song a few weeks later and is like, wait, my nephew sang a song that sounded just like that. So yeah, it's a possibility.
Yep, yep.
That, you know, two artists can have very similar ideas and whatnot. So, but despite all of, you know, that hiccup for a few years, the song was huge and it became Stevie Wonder's best-selling single worldwide, even though many people kind of some people are kind of like, it's not that they hate it, but they're like, yeah, it's like that song, like it kind of view it as like cheesy. Mm-hmm. Which I can get that. I get that. It's because as the guy Tom was saying, it is very simplistic song. It's not there's nothing over the top about it. It's just straightforward. I just called to say I love you, not because of any special day, not because of any special occasion, and that's it. Those are the words, you know. It's just straightforward. But you know, despite people having lukewarm feelings about it, it was a huge, huge, it's his biggest record. So, well, biggest selling record, I should say. Mm-hmm. I think songs like Isn't She Lovely and other things are just as big in the social consciousness of everybody when they think of Stevie Wonder. But
yeah. But you can hear like a whole room, like, especially back in the day, like a whole people, like we put that song on and everybody in the room is singing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like exactly. Everybody in the room, because it's exactly. It's catchy, it's whatever. But also, mm-hmm. like I'm kind of playing the song in my head. I'm like, and it also has all his frills still. Like it's simple, but like he is soulfully mm-hmm. singing. Yeah, I do. You know, like he's doing all of his stuff that, to me, I don't see it simple. And there's just a feeling.
Yeah,
there's a feeling, a specific feeling to it that mm-hmm. I can't describe.
I love it. I think it's great. I don't have lukewarm feelings, but I think it's mm-hmm. it's just a good song. It definitely has that 80s sound, but it's still just a I was listening to it and I'm just like, it's Stevie and his voice that like it makes it what it is. If this was just some mm-hmm. you know, some random, like if Madonna sang this song, it'd be boring. in my opinion. Like, it's Stevie's voice and his emotion,
right,
and the soul that he puts into it. Like, it is this very simple, straightforward song, but it's his emotion that he puts into it that, like, I just called to say I love you. That's just like, dang, you right. I just, like, he just called to say he loved me. Like, so I think that's, it's him. Like, he is the essence that makes it special. Y'all don't start throwing rocks at me, all you Madonna fans
also,
out there.
Also, kind of like, but, when there's no Halloween, there's kind of a gloom in that part of the song, and then it's just like it goes from like this like gloominess with the synths and everything, has this kind of a gloomy feeling, and then cut to this joyous like you know, and then it's like and then it goes back and forth. I feel like that's probably what the feeling is for me, like a gloom coupled with joy in the song.
Another just random fact, Diana Ross sang it at the Oscars that year, 1985, when it was when it won. So I don't know why Stevie didn't perform it, but Diana Ross did it, and she did a fine job. It's Diana Ross. Yep. And that's all on YouTube. You can go watch that performance. You can go watch his acceptance speech when he won. Yeah, I feel bad for Ray Parker Jr. You could tell he wanted it. he was like, I want this Oscar. But yeah, it's all right. Everybody still loves the song. And it's still huge. So it's all right. You didn't win the award, but that song still lives on in the hearts of many. Maybe I should cover that song someday. Who you gonna call? So anyways, that's I Just Called to Say I Love You by Stevie Wonder. And I'd written down, because I was telling Digo I have a list of just songs so I can just pull from if I don't have one specifically. And everything else on the list is the actual song and an artist, but then I just put Stevie Wonder any song. Literally. Because I was like, he has so many, and so I literally just went to Spotify and I was like, what are the top three? Okay.
Yeah.
And then, we went with this.
Now, let's get back to the Olympic categories of vocalists and performers. So your vocalists are?
So my vocalists are Stevie Wonder, Whitney Houston, and Patti LaBelle. Whitney. And this is, again, keep in mind, we're talking 1992. And I did that specifically, so I didn't want to make it, because I felt, it's like, many other vocalists that I love now that have newer artists like Brandy and stuff. So I didn't want to,
I did keep it a little bit old school. And then for your performers, it's Michael,
Prince, and Tina Turner.
And Tina. All right. So
there's
everything. But I think I have a formidable team against you. Okay, so on one hand, we got Stevie, Whitney, and Patti going against none other than Mariah, Aretha, and Freddie.
I gotta stop you right there.
That is a game.
Freddie, I know. I'm not lying. I know I only mentioned Peebo, but also I was thinking Freddie. I was like, yeah,
that's Mariah Carey, amazing. Aretha Franklin, and Freddie Mercury, for those curious. All right, yeah.
That's a formidable opponent on the vocalist side.
I'll watch it.
Formidable opponents. Yeah.
For performers, you got Michael, Prince, and Tina Turner. I pulled out old school, because the way they just used to just rock on the stage is what I've always... Chuck Berry, James Brown,
Mm-hmm.
And I did bring in something to just, I mean, you got Michael. I mean, I need Beyonce, okay? All right? All right? That's a good game. That is good game. You got good. Michael Prisantina. I got Chuck Berry, James Brown, and Beyonce. That's fight good. To the death.
That is. I was thinking of James Brown. I was thinking of the Rolling Stones, I'm sure, was like their great as well. Even Freddie. I mean, you could say Queen. Like, I'm sure they were.
Sure.
I mean, that performance at Live Aid was enough to say.
Yeah, Chuck Berry, it's just those the energy he brought on stage.
Oh, yeah.
James Brown, the energy he would. Sorry, that's the other way around. James Brown, the energy he brought on stage with his everything. And then Chuck Berry, he brought into the guitar and the way he just played that. And it just the energy they would have. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Beyonce. But if we could watch that tournament.
That would be.
And to the listeners, good luck.
Exactly. I just have to say some honorable mentions as far as vocalists go. Anita Baker, Cyndi Lauper, amazing. Gladys Knight also, I got to throw her in there. And performers, of course, this is Janet. Janet is killing it as well. And like I said, you know, I'm sure the Rolling Stones and Queen would be great too. But yeah, I just thought that would be interesting. I'm like, yeah, like if we had a dream team of musicians, like who are we putting up to represent us? So yeah, y'all have fun with that one.
Yeah, good luck topping that list. Exactly. Our players, this is our dream team. We got these couple of teams. I'm open to hear international listeners. They will have obviously things that we have never heard of, hopefully.
And even people we have, because I mean, if you think just thinking of the 80s again, that was that British invasion, so you have a lot of
I mean the Beatles.
Duran,
but you know what, I think we all mentioned, let me see, Stevie, Whitney, Patty, Mariah, Aretha, Freddie. Well, Freddie was in a band, but I'm saying most of these were like, and Prince was also had his band, but most of them were like, this is the artist versus the Beatles were a dream team of their own band. Yeah. So, not saying that that's what you have to stick to, but like, we have pretty much like lead
exactly solo artists. Oh, yeah. Very true.
Yeah. Freddie can get up on stage with his guitar and a microphone and be fine. So can Michael. So can Prince. So can, like all of these. They don't need anybody else. They could just be themselves and play. Correct.
Cool. I had to break it up because, you know, Whitney's not doing what Janet's doing, but Janet's not doing what Whitney's doing. Mm-hmm. So I think. Yeah, I had to make that distinction between there's just amazing singers and then there's amazing performers. So write us. Let us know who your contenders are.
I'm pitting Mariah Carey against your Whitney.
Of course.
Freddie against your Stevie and Aretha against your Patty.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the individual games. And then, of course, Beyonce against your Michael.
Mm-hmm.
And then the stage explodes and there's no more games.
It's canceled.
There's too much pyrotechnics and stuff. Exactly. And it's like everything just explodes. It's on fire. We have to cancel the game.
Yes.
Cool. Well.
Cool. Well, that's it. Fight for what you love.
Especially for what's right.
Amen.
All right.
I don't know why I hear RuPaul in my head. Because if you can't love yourself, how the hell are you going to love somebody else?
Can I get an amen?
Amen.
Now let the music play.
Exactly.